ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors of the ETF Store. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Investing in ETFs involves risk, including potential loss of principal. Any past performance figures discussed are not necessarily indicative of future results. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate will help you get up to date with what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, you already know what I'm covering this week. Dave Portnoy and this VanEck Buzz ETF. I'll be joined in just a moment by ETF.com's Drew Voros. We're going to look at the many compelling storylines here from the ETF itself, which was reincarnated from a past failed life, to obviously Barstool's Dave Portnoy being involved. And I think shaking up marketing and compliance departments, it probably every ETF issuer. I've called this a game changer for the industry. There's also a performance angle. So Drew and I will have some fun batting this around. And I'll tell you right now, Drew's pretty opinionated on this topic. Also joining me this week will be Rich Lee, head of program and ETF trading at Robert W. Baird. And what's interesting here is Baird is an authorized participant. They're part of the magic that helps keep ETF prices in line with the value of the securities they hold. And longtime listeners know I always enjoy sort of pulling back the curtain on ETFs. And that's what we'll do here. We'll go behind the scenes and talk about the creation and redemption process of ETFs. Though I should note, this won't just be a discussion on the mechanics of ETFs. There's actually some pretty timely stories I want to get Rich's take on as well, to include whether ARK ETFs could get into some sort of doom loop if investors start selling in mass. And then there was this BIS report, Bank for International Settlements report, that got a ton of media attention last week. It was on bond ETFs and whether ETF issuers were dumping their lowest quality holdings on APs during the market crisis last March. So this should be an excellent conversation and one I think ETF nerds will certainly enjoy. And then to close this week, I'll be joined by Joel Shulman, founder and chief investment officer at ERShares, who's behind two ETFs that focus on what Joel calls the entrepreneur factor. And I've got to tell you, Joel puts this factor in the same category as momentum or value or size, just in terms of its robustness. He actually wrote a book on this topic. So I'll have Joel explain that factor. We'll, of course, spotlight the two ETFs. And then I'll also get his take on the thematic ETF landscape overall. Joel says they were one of the first thematic investment managers some 16 years ago. As always, questions or comments, you can find me on Twitter at Nate Geraci, or you can go to ETFprime.com. Let's start this week with ETF.com's Drew Voros.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
I think we're seeing a different way of ETFs being launched. The real kicker was governance, selling of private data. They really let down their customers repeatedly.
Drew, thanks for joining me this week.
My pleasure as always, Nate.
Okay, so I've got to ask you, are you a Barstool Sports and Dave Portnoy fan?
Well, I've never been really familiar with the content itself until probably the last few years when I saw it on Twitter. But I think it's kind of indicative of what we're going to talk about, just sort of the disruption and the no rules apply here kind of attitude that he brings to whatever endeavor he seems to be a part of. You know, they started out sort of anti-ESPN, providing, you know, fantasy picks and taking on sports advertising as a print product, basically in Boston, and doing things like pizza reviews, which are very well known for now. So it's sort of an entertainment company, really, at the end of the day. And I think that's what he's bringing to the ETF table is frankly, entertainment.
Yeah, no question, and I want to come back to that. I mean, obviously, Dave Portnoy is the big story here. However, let's start by first discussing the ETF itself, the VanEck Vectors Social Sentiment ETF, ticker BUZZ, B-U-Z-Z. And the long story short is, back in 2016, there was the Sprott BUZZ Social Media Insights ETF, ticker B-U-Z, 1-Z. That tracked the same index, but it only took in like $8, $9 million in assets, and it ended up closing in 2019. Do you remember covering that ETF back at the time?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it made sense on the surface, but they also didn't have a P.T. Barnum selling it. So that was a big difference. We have a huge marketing difference. Plus, the idea, can social media move markets? And certainly with GameStop, we've seen that, where, and we saw Wall Street Bets come from Reddit, basically transfer this conversation onto social media, and it's clearly moved markets. So we've seen it in action. So that helps with traction. And before, I think we have many ETFs like this. I like to say they left the movie early. We used to have a airline ETF, FAA, if you recall. They left, and here came Jets, and now it's a $3 billion fund. So a lot of ideas come along that are smart and make sense, and for whatever reason don't work. And this is the case, I think, with social media sentiment. It is an idea that has, you know, sort of the narrative. This hasn't just started online. There is a lot of research into sentiment and how it drives stocks and securities. And, you know, here it's scraping from social media. Although I have to say, after looking into this a little bit, it's really not social media. It's primarily Twitter, and it's primarily stock tweets. But that's also the active voices when it comes to stocks. People don't necessarily talk stocks on Facebook like they do on Twitter and StockTwits. So there is a little bit of a narrow focus when it comes to this, and I'm not quite sure what it was 10 years ago. I think it was a little bit wider focus. So, I mean, in terms of the general idea, it makes sense. I think it makes sense to a lot of people who are just coming out of the wake of GameStop and seeing how markets can move. How quick this fund can move is going to be the question. And the fact is, Buzz doesn't even own GameStop. So here's the stock that had the most movement because of social media is not even in this fund. What it does have is 75 basic large cap funds, you know, sort of the ones you would expect, the Netflix and Facebook. So in terms of what it is today and what it was before, I can't give you the actual index methodology difference. But clearly, there's a different environment for this today.
It is interesting. The index provider, BUZZ Holdings, that was founded by a guy named Jamie Wise. And even though BUZ closed, he did continue refining the index and keeping this idea alive. And I know one of the things, actually, I think Heather Bell at ETF.com may have wrote about this, was that he actually had to retrain the model for things like the use of emojis in social media. I thought that was interesting. Mm-hmm. And that the index analyzed about 2 million posts every month back, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. Now that number is over 15 million. But to your point, this is 75 large cap U.S. stocks. There are some constraints here. You mentioned GameStop stock. I think that's an interesting one because this index has a minimum market cap of at least $5 billion. And so when the GameStop saga occurred, its market cap wasn't in a place for this index to pick it up quickly. And, you know, you mentioned it is scraping data from places like Twitter, certainly Reddit, StockTwits. I saw even Benzinga and some mainstream media sites like CNN and Barron's. It's using natural language processing technology to try to sort through all this data and really determine the sentiment. And then it ranks and scores these stocks based on the degree of positive sentiment and the overall breadth of discussion. And I should mention it's 75 basis points in terms of the expense ratio. And if you go back to the index's inception, it has beaten the S&P 500 for whatever that's worth. Does it surprise you that VanEck picked up this ETF, or do you think it fits with the direction they're heading?
Well, VanEck is always looking for a spot in the marketplace. They were the first back in the day with the gold miners ETF, which is one of the most popular trading vehicles on Wall Street right now. And so they've always looked for those kinds of pockets of market that, you know, maybe are underserved, or that, again, here's a good idea that just didn't work at the time and maybe it's going to work now. And as you mentioned, Jamie Wise is known in the ETF circles, so obviously came with the index credibility and the pairing up with Portnoy is certainly what I think you want to talk about, and how this has kind of been the bull in the China shop compliance when it comes to ETF. And I think it's great on that service. It's way overdue to have this conversation about what ETF issuers can and can't say regarding an ETF, particularly when it's about to launch. And at ETF.com, we come through this hurdle all the time where we can't have a real honest conversation with an issuer before something launches because they're in a quiet period or whatever you want to be in. And that just seems antithesis to everything investors need, which is information. So whether it's coming bombastically like it is now through buzz, and we'll see how this does, it's attracted $283 million in the first week. So there is definitely an interest in this. And certainly, you know, with Barstool Sports and 2.5 million, 3 million people following them on Twitter, there's obviously an audience there that they're speaking directly to. How the SEC and FINRA and everybody digest this, because they are dancing around some very delicate compliance lines, and having, you know, Barstool Sports sort of be this third party, but really isn't the third party. They are associated with it, but not when it comes to certain compliance things. So how this is looked at and dealt with, or is it even going to be dealt with? So it's very interesting, but clearly there's two sets of rules going on right now. Here's a launch that came out very loud, and frankly, the way you think a launch is, you know, see a movie launch, there's lots of commercials beforehand when a new car comes out. But yet we'll launch an ETF and not tell investors clearly what it is as an ETF issuer is because compliance tells them they cannot. And to me, being in journalism and information gathering, how we can have launches that where you have issuers restricted in what they can say seems silly to me, frankly.
I think it's interesting if we look back in terms of how this all built up. We were talking about Dave Portnoy at the top, and I think whatever you think of Dave Portnoy, there's no question he's got the marketing figured out, right? I just don't think that can be disputed. And what was amazing to me last year was just seeing how quickly he rose in the financial world. So, you know, when the pandemic hit, he in sports betting, there were no sports, so he couldn't bet on sports. He made this pivot over to stocks. And I thought it was funny because there are people that spend their entire lives trying to get on CNBC to talk investing, and he did it in like a month after taking up stocks as a hobby. And so, you know, I think we fast forward to where we're at now. You know, clearly he built that profile in the financial or investment space. And then we had this GameStop saga that we mentioned earlier. So really, it's a perfect time to launch the strategy. I think there is this feeling of Main Street versus Wall Street that retail investors can outsmart the suits. And so the timing seems much better. And then, you know, to your point, you look last week, this Buzz ETF, it did take in $280 million on its first day of trading, which that was one of the best ETF debuts ever. And prior to the launch, on Monday of last week, I believe it was Monday, Portnoy changed his Twitter avatar to the Buzz ETF logo. And then on Tuesday, he tweeted out what I thought was a classic Barstool video. And actually, if you don't mind, let me play this. This thing was extremely well-produced. I'm going to play a snippet here.
Okay, if you know anything about me, you know if I'm standing in front of this water cooler, I have a big announcement to make, and I do have a big announcement to make. This Thursday, on the New York Stock Exchange, there is a new ETF launching, a new ETF that I'm part of, that I'm putting my face behind, my reputation behind. Everything over the last 20 years, when I stand here and say, I believe in it, I believe in what we're doing, it's another one of those moments. The name of the ETF is Buzz, B-U-Z-Z, like zzz, zzz, stung, all right? Like a.
And so, of course, Dave Portnoy goes on to tell his 2.5 million Twitter followers that this ETF was launching on Thursday. And so here we are. But as you were saying, I mean, he's obviously built this huge following through Barstool Sports. And I just go back to last year. He really propelled himself into the mainstream with the Davey Day Trader videos. He got pretty involved in the markets. And now we have this video produced where the word index is dubbed over in the video to be ETF. It's such an amazing story.
Well, it's akin to Donald Trump hitting the political scene. Doesn't care what the rules are. People are shocked, and you can't do this. But nobody seems to be stopping him. So we'll see how far this goes. And it's also something I don't think you'll see emulated quickly. I don't think issuers want to just go in there. And he also is in a certain area where he can get away with this. He's not a registered investment advisor. He's not you know, associated that in any way. What he is a celebrity attaching himself to a security. How the SEC and FINRA and others deal with that, who knows? Maybe they won't deal with it at all. Maybe this is the way we'll start seeing marketing where, you know, putting a person in front of the ETF will be the new way to introduce certain parts of the ETF industry. But I think we could get a little bit silly in exaggerating what we would see, because I think at some level it gets to a point where I don't think issuers have the stomach for it.
Well, it's interesting. Van Eck, I think they've tried to distance themselves a little bit. They've said, hey, look, you know, he's not involved with our firm. He's with the index provider. And so that's how they attempt to wash their hands of this. I've been amazed, Drew, just I think about this particular podcast. I've been doing this for 10 years now, and I can't tell you how many times there's been honestly a fantastic educational interview with an ETF issuer. And I talked to that issuer. They're like, this is perfect. This is exactly the type of information we want to get out to investors. And they can't do it without jumping through a bunch of compliance hoops. And I've just never understood that. I mean, I get not touting performance and things like that. But otherwise, why can't they share good information?
Well, I'll give you a problem we have. You know, when we were owned by Cboe, we were able to get Cboe launches and 48-hour notification when a new launch was coming from their trading desks. And that was because we had that corporate relationship. And now that we've been sold, we don't have that. However, we still get notifications from Cboe. Other exchanges, NASDAQ and NYSE, do not proactively tell the media about a launch, at least to ETF.com, which you think would be logical. So it's always been a struggle for information when a new fund comes along. The issuers can't really help us. Exchanges sometimes aren't cooperative. And, you know, once in a while we'll get some good PR people that will kind of mitigate that, help us get an interview before a launch so we can tell readers what this new product is about. That is the fundamental problem we have, is just getting, especially a more complex ETF, and trying to explain it to the public. Here's this very interesting ETF that's launching today that you may be interested in, but we can't talk to the issuer until it launches, and we'll catch up to them tomorrow and get back to you. It just makes no sense when it comes to information and education. We all go to these conferences. That's all we hear about. We need more information. Investors need more education. And then here we have all these regulation and compliance issues that stifle communication. And so hopefully
100%.
Maybe this will erode that wall a little bit, because I don't think Portney is going to go away. And I think the success will beget success. He's one of these guys that once he does something, he's going to continue to do it until he fails, and he'll move on to something else. So I would suspect that this thing continues to take off. We will see him continue to sit in this ETF space. The other thing that's interesting, too, to keep your eye on is the ETF rule has really lowered the threshold to entering into the ETF market. If he has some kind of success here, and he obviously has already succeeded in other areas, you know, we could see a whole new kind of breed of ETF issuer. That would be very interesting to me. Right now, he still has that degree of separation where he's really not in it, and Van Eck can say, well, he's really not part of us. But if we had a real ETF issuer that's trying to break the rules, such as a Donald Trump running for president, I think that would be really interesting and certainly in the realm of possibilities.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I've called this a game changer for the industry. And you may have seen, I sent out a tweet about a month ago that got a lot of traction, which told me this topic touched a nerve. This was before the Buzz ETF. I tweeted out that you have people like Elon Musk and Snoop Dogg. They're out there pumping Dogecoin, but ETF issuers can't retweet basic articles on their products. And it just doesn't make sense to me that we can't get more information into the hands of investors, educational information. And so I like this because, again, regardless of whether or not you like Dave Portnoy and Barstool, he is changing the game here. He's putting some pressure on regulators, and I think he has ETF issuers looking around saying, okay, well, what can we do? Maybe we have been a little too tight on the compliance side. And, Drew, you know me. I mean, I think it's very important that we have proper protections in place for investors. There are a lot of complicated products out there. But I think the way through that is education. And that may sound cliche, but I truly believe it. The more educational information we can get in investors' hands, the better off everybody's going to be. And who better to deliver that than the ETF issuers themselves? Go ahead.
I agree. And with what we have right now, we don't have regulation of what people are saying. We have people not saying anything. And then you have this come along that they're saying anything they want. There's no in between. So what I would think real regulation would be is like, yeah, please talk about your product, but we are going to regulate what you can say about it. So you can't say, we think this is going to return three times your money
exactly.
in 3 years.
Yeah.
So regulate the speech like you do in ads, like car dealers have to do in ads, but don't completely stifle it right when people need to know information. And that's what's happening, and that's what the beauty of this launch was to me, was saying, we don't care about this quiet period because it's ridiculous, and we're going to try to sell this product. The means justify the end, I'm not sure, but the fact is that we're having this discussion right now, and I hope, hopefully regulators will take it to a higher level than just on Twitter and your podcast, because it is a real problem.
Yeah, I was just going to say, another angle that I thought was fascinating here was Portnoy was tweeting at firms like Merrill Lynch, who hadn't approved the Buzz ETF on their platform, which this has obviously been a pretty big pain point for many ETF issuers, right, where those platforms won't allow new or smaller asset ETFs.
Right.
And here we have Portnoy shining a pretty bright light on that issue. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Again, it's Rodney Dangerfield in the country club, right? So we don't care what you think. We're going to say it right to your face. And then we'll see how it goes. And I think one thing, I think we all agree on, you know, America's about freedom of speech. And this doesn't seem like freedom of speech when you have this dichotomy about who can say what, who can't say what. That just doesn't seem right in America.
All right, Drew, before I let you go, just for fun here, what would be your ideal celebrity ETF matchup? If you had a pair of celebrity sort of endorser within the ETF, who would that be?
Well, I would take the old school of way you used to name things. You wait till people pass away so they can't, you know, damage themselves while they're alive. But in terms of a name, I think I kicked it around with you, especially here in Northern California, John Muir is really revered, especially with Yosemite. Nature, there's museums, schools, roads, John Muir ESG fund, for instance. So taking a name and putting the credibility of that name, you know, sort of as a you know, endorsement of sorts, because certainly the estates would have to sign off on that. But I think, what you know, having this sort of, we had the Quincy Jones ETF proposed, and other actual singular people that are alive and living kind of names, I don't think that's going to pass muster much. And I think it also is a big risk, just like it, with active managers. When that active manager goes away, what happens to your fund? You know, when this celebrity, you know, has a bad turn in life or simply goes away, what happens to your fund? So it really has a very short shelf life in that way. Whereas a name like John Muir or some revered, long-established name, you know, Abe Lincoln, for instance, you know, something like that, maybe. But I don't see this going into the celebrity naming of an ETF, but I certainly could see where we're going to have some endorsements that will push the line of anything that we've seen before, if this is allowed to continue.
I've got to tell you, I put that question out on Twitter, and there were a lot of Snoop Dogg in a marijuana ETF, but somebody had a Snooki and the tan ETF. I thought that was pretty good. But Drew, we're going to have to leave it there. Fun chat this week. I always appreciate the time. Thank you.
Always, Nate. Take care.
That was ETF.com's Drew Voros.
Stop.
My next guest is Rich Lee, head of program and ETF trading at Robert W. Baird, who's an international financial services firm with over $170 billion in client assets. And Rich himself is an expert on all the ins and outs of ETF trading, rebalancing, everything that goes on behind the scenes of ETFs. And interestingly, Baird recently became an authorized participant for ETFs in August of last year. Rich is now joining me via phone from New York. Rich, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Nate. Thanks for having me.
Rich, first, just tell us a little bit more about your specific role at Baird, especially as it pertains to ETFs.
Sure. So basically, on the program trading and ETF desk here at Baird, we basically help our customers execute large baskets of stocks or ETFs. And so that could be a fund that's putting money to work across all names in a fund, or they could be doing a redemption or rebalance, or trading ETFs can be part of a program, and they may be looking to do an NAV trade, or they may be looking to have us facilitate a creation redemption on their behalf. So those are some of the things that we do on our desk, and our overall goal is to basically help our customers source liquidity as best they can.
And then what about the AP rule? So that started in August of last year. How did Baird get involved there?
Sure. So, you know, as you think about the ETF ecosystem, authorized participants play an important role in the facilitation and the liquidity and the price discovery process for ETFs, right? So if you think about it from the issuer side, if you're a ETF issuer, you want to have authorized participants that are going to be there and facilitate trading, i.e. creation, redemption of your products, as well as market making, so basically providing liquidity on the screens so that their ETFs can have a robust ecosystem. And then for institutional customers, where authorized participants can come into play, is they can actually help further facilitate that liquidity profile. So for instance, if a institutional customer came to us and said, hey, I would like to buy 250,000 shares of this ETF, but it only trades, say, 100,000 shares a day, if you were to basically just kind of go out, if there were not market makers making a market in that stock or there wasn't deep liquidity in it, for instance, you would probably have non-trivial impact by buying that 250,000 shares of the ETF straight in the marketplace. What you could instead do is look at the underlying baskets on behalf of the customer, buy that basket, and invoke the creation process with the ETF provider and give them the in-kind of 250,000 shares of that ETF, thereby facilitating that transaction, facilitating liquidity in that name or ETF.
Right, and obviously authorized participants, they play a critical role just in helping keep the price of an ETF in line with the value of its underlying assets. I always like to say, this is really where the magic of ETFs happens, which I'm sure you agree with. I guess on that note, can you talk about how Baird approaches this process? Like, is it all algorithmically driven? How competitive is it with other APs? Like how big do the premiums and discounts need to be? Just give us a window into this process.
Sure. So I'll speak directly towards the creation redemption process as opposed to things like market making or arbitrage in the marketplace, right? But with regard to creation redemptions, it's actually a pretty, I don't want to use the word boring, but it's definitely a methodical process-driven approach, right? It's not like you're trading on screens, algos. It basically, in simplest terms, if I were to do a creation, I would log on to a provider website, and I would say, hey, I would like to create 3 units of this ETF. That message gets transmitted to the ETF custodian. They acknowledge that. You would then download what's known as a portfolio composition file, which is the constituents and the weights that make up that respective ETF. And then you would then, at the end of the day, deliver them that basket in that weights, and they would in turn deliver you the ETF in NAV terms. And then the opposite is true for a redemption. So it really is sort of more of a clearing function. Now, with regard to if you have to position yourself so that you have the stock to deliver for the ETF and you need to trade and there may be stocks that are a little bit more liquid, that's where we actually employ technology, algorithms, and liquidity-seeking technology on our desk to find the best price possible for our customers.
Well, and that's what's interesting to me. I mean, there are a lot of variables here, and I'm curious, I mean, can you talk more about if you're looking at a creation or redemption, how to ensure that that is a profitable endeavor for Baird?
Sure. I think it's a function of having having straight through operational efficiency, right? If you're thinking about a typical ETF transaction, I mean, let's take something as vanilla as the spiders, right? 506 stocks in the S&P 500, 506 stocks that need to be booked and processed. So you want to make sure that you have a high transaction and settlement efficacy rate. You want to minimize manual intervention as much as you can, because that can lead to errors. And you just want to make sure that you have your operational processes tight from a clearing perspective. And then from a trading perspective, you want to make sure that you have technology that's seeking the best price when you have to trade in the market.
Rich, I thought as a way to help listeners better understand the role of an AP, it might be interesting to get your take on some interesting stories that are out in the ETF marketplace right now. And one of the biggest is ARK Invest. Obviously, ARK is a huge success story overall, but you know, their performance has taken a bit of a step back here recently. And there's a lot of debate around how ARK might unwind some of their concentrated positions if their ETFs get hit with redemptions. I think some believe they could enter what's referred to as a doom loop, a negative feedback loop, because they currently own at least 10% of the float for something like 25 to 30 stocks. What insight can you offer here? Like, does that cause you any concerns?
No, it doesn't. And in fact, I actually find, having done this for a while, I find this whole conversation that's happening around the ARK ETFs and other transparent ETFs and this sort of doom loop phenomenon that you referenced kind of interesting, right? Because if you think about what ARK is doing, they've had tremendous success marketing a transparent ETF product, right? And this ETF product allows customers the ability to enter and exit quickly, right, real time, have real time pricing. There's tax efficiencies associated with, you know, having an ETF. But really, if you think about it and take a step back, is it that different from a traditional active money manager that holds a portfolio of stocks, right, whether it be a value-oriented or growth-oriented manager? So from that perspective, you know, I don't see that there's inherently more risk than that corresponding active money manager, right? Now, the fact that they are a ETF and a transparent ETF, I would argue actually allows for greater liquidity and greater facilitation because of some of the things we talked about. You have market makers out there that are providing a two-sided market so that if things start to get dislocated either on the underlying basket side or on the ETF side, ARBs can step in. There's an opportunity there to keep things kind of level. And then, again, with regard to the creation redemption process, the authorized participant, you know, potentially allows the ability to kind of facilitate a creation redemption that, you know, may be a custom basket so that you don't have to necessarily sell out of the most illiquid name, per se, and there's some flexibility there. So I would say that, you know, again, if you look at specifically in this case of the ARK ETF, you're not really looking at anything, or you're not really having a conversation that's that, I think, dramatically different than you would have with a traditional value manager that is managing a fund, right, in terms of positions and what they're doing from an investment perspective. But I will say that you do have the added, I guess, benefit of the ETF wrapper, and with that, you know, the authorized participant.
You mentioned custom baskets. I'm not sure if you saw last week, Dave Nodig over at ETF Trends, he had a fantastic interview with the ARK chief operating officer. And I want to read you a passage from that. So the ARK COO, he said, you know, like, being an ETF really helps us. In extreme case, we can do this with a custom basket. And that's probably the part that never gets talked about. If you really get into a situation where you want out of a name, we can work with authorized participants to in-kind out the name we are exiting through custom baskets. People talk about the short interest in some of these names. Sometimes those are names that market makers want to do a custom basket on because they can close a bunch of positions all at once without going into the market and driving the price up by covering their shorts. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. And I think he's highlighting what I talked about, right, with regard to the role that the authorized participant can play in the liquidity facilitation process. You know, I'll give a little bit of an example that near and dear to anybody that's been following the retail world lately, GameStop, right? The XRT, which is the retail ETF, has GameStop as a component of that ETF. And at one point during the height of everything that was going on with GameStop, I think there was like something like north of a 60% redemption of XRTs, right? And you could easily see people doing that because they wanted to redeem out of the XRTs, not because there was any sort of, you know, belief in the inherent, you know, value or discount in the price of the XRT, but because they wanted to redeem out of the XRT so that they could receive back the GameStop shares that were part of it, so that maybe they could potentially lend it out or, you know, meet short obligations or you know, fill a short position. So, you know, that's one way in which people can kind of use the creation redemption process.
Well, and I think what's interesting there is, you know, ETFs have multiple APs associated with them, and those APs all may have differing goals and objectives, to your
That's
point.
Right.
And so, you know, that that can act as another release valve or buffer. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that if you look at mutual funds, if a mutual fund is hit with redemptions, they have one option, right, which is to sell
right.
directly into the market to raise cash. That's it.
That's
the only option. I'm curious, you know, the ARK ETFs, they are actively managed. Are there any differences in how APs hedge risk on an active ETF versus an index ETF, or is it all the same process?
I think, you know, the overall risk management process is the same in terms of, do you have your technology in place? Do you have your systems in place? How are you thinking about risk? How are you looking at sort of, you know, cash positions? How are you looking at correlation of positions that you have? But that said, I think it is a little bit different with a traditional, say, index ETF like the SPDRs or, you know, the XLE or the XLK than a transparent or semi-transparent ETF, just because there's a little bit of nuance around the creation redemption process that's not as sort of straightforward as the vanilla creation redemption for a straight indexed ETF product.
You're saying on the semi-transparent side,
yes,
there can be some differences.
What
like what kind of differences would there be in terms of the AP process?
Sure. So for instance, I think that there are currently about five approved semi-transparent structures that are approved, right, for semi-transparent ETFs. So you have firms like Percadian, Blue Tractor, the New York Stock Exchange, and then Fidelity and T. Rowe, which were just approved for their products. And if you think about what makes it transparent is they all have different ways of they are actively managed ETFs, but they have different ways of, I guess, expressing their transparency, right, of their holdings. And I think the goal is obviously rather than something that's fully transparent, which all the holdings and weights are disclosed, the semi-transparent, there's some notion of either weights or names or positions, right? So for instance, you could have, in the case of Percadian, the actual ETF holdings are disclosed daily, but only to an authorized participant representative, right? So
right.
there's an abstraction layer, right? If you look at something like T. Rowe, they're using something like a proxy portfolio that's disclosed daily with at least over 80% overlap between the actual ETF holdings. So there is some sort of component of abstraction involved with how these semi-transparent ETFs are going to market. And that's, you know, by and large to protect, obviously, the provider, right?
Right. Now, and from what I've seen, so I hear you, it sounds like there's more complexity on the back end. The one thing I will say is APs appear to be doing a great job here, because if you look at the spreads on those products that are out in the wild right now, they're pretty tight overall.
Yep.
And comparable to transparent active ETFs. Rich, just a few minutes left. I want to ask you about this BIS, Bank for International Settlements, report on bond ETFs that came out last week. And there was a lot here. I read the whole thing. It was like 15 or 16 pages. But if I had to boil it down, basically the report suggested that bond ETF issuers were handing APs lower quality baskets during the turmoil in March of last year. And I think where the report was heading was that this then left the remaining ETF portfolio at a higher quality, and therefore investors would be less likely to sell. It might also make APs less likely to redeem, which is why bond ETFs were trading at discounts. And so the point was all of this actually functioned as a stabilizing force in the bond market. You essentially had risk transferred to investors who wanted to transact in this environment. Do you agree with that takeaway and any other color you might offer here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do think that because of that mechanism, you think of it almost as a safety valve, right? So rather than if there's a panicked period in the marketplace where everybody feels that they want to exit, right, for short-term liquidity constraints, the AP can step in and say, wait a minute, we're going to facilitate this, certainly, but there's ways that we can do this that satisfy liquidity constraints of the end investor that's looking for the liquidity, as well as the ETF provider, right, that is the manager of the ETF and the authorized participant who is going to play a role in facilitating that. And if they can help facilitate that in a way that makes sense for everybody, i.e., the ETF issuer is not forced to sell out of, to your point, lower quality bonds that may be illiquid, right? But the authorized participant can also work with them to deliver in-kind baskets. Then I think that's a situation that does help kind of, I don't want to say, it's almost, I guess I would say, is a nice sort of mechanism that sits between and kind of allows for a little bit more flexibility in the marketplace.
One thing that I'll hear from ETF naysayers is this thought that APs might just walk away in distressed markets. And I've always shot that down by just saying, look, money rules everything, right? And I think you were alluding to this earlier. If there's truly an arbitrage profit opportunity, that financial incentive is enough to keep the machinery functioning properly. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting, right? Because that's the argument that you hear time and time again for market makers or market participants in general, right? And I think, you know, the more participants you have in the marketplace, the more people that contribute to the ecosystem, the more players you're going to have that have different incentives and motivations, right? So whereas, you know, I might be looking to liquidate, someone may be looking to sell, right? Or if things get dislocated enough, it kind of wakes buyers up. So you know, absolutely, I think that having a robust ecosystem helps kind of ensure that these products keep trading and keep liquidity on the screens.
Well, Rich, a very insightful conversation this week. This is actually a topic I haven't dug into probably as much as I should. We'll have to do this again. Thank you for joining me.
Absolutely. Thank you for your time, and I love doing this.
That was Rich Lee, head of program and ETF trading at Robert W. Baird. I'm now joined by Joel Shulman, founder and chief investment officer at ER Shares, who currently offers two ETFs with over $200 million invested. They also offer mutual funds and separately managed accounts, about $800 million in firm assets altogether. And the blueprint for their investment process was actually laid out in a book Joel authored. It's titled Getting Bigger by Growing Smaller, A New Growth Model for Corporate America. That was born out of research developed at Harvard University. And I'm now very pleased to have Joel on the line with me from Boston. Joel, it's a pleasure. Thanks for taking the time.
And thanks for having me here. It's always fun to participate in these podcasts, so thank you.
All right, so let's start with what you call the entrepreneur factor. So my understanding is you believe this should be held in the same regard as value or momentum or size. So explain for us what this is and why you do believe it holds up against some of these other well-known factors.
Well, actually, we've tested this numerous times using analytics on Bloomberg, where they have 30-plus factors, you know, similar to what you mentioned in terms of momentum and size and growth and so forth. And what we found is that over an extended period of time, not only is the what we call the entrepreneur factor significant, it's frequently the most significant over a period of time and sometimes more significant than all the other well-known factors combined. And so we're very proud of this factor, and it's a trait that, you know, transcends, you know, centuries in terms of growth in economies globally speaking. So we're, you know, this is something we've discovered, and it's something that's been true a long time.
And so explain that factor. What exactly does it represent?
Well, it really, first and foremost, represents the key leaders of any organization. And, you know, it turns out leadership matters. And so, you know, having the right mix, having the right charismatic, you know, leaders, they're fully invested. It's more than just the money. They do this because it's also, you know, driven by ego. When you think about the innovations and disruptions happening, you know, globally, it's a handful of people and their tight team that stay together, and they work, you know, night and day to create solutions. And so it's really all about execution. So it's really the team and the way they manage the resources.
Okay, so the two ETFs you offer that are based on this entrepreneur factor, you have the ER Shares Entrepreneurs ETF, ticker symbol ENTR, and the ER Shares Next Gen Entrepreneurs ETF, ticker symbol ERSX. Take us through these ETFs, maybe starting with ENTR.
So ENTR was our first ETF. It was launched over 3.5 years ago, and it primarily invests in U.S. large cap companies, you know, very liquid companies. But it's more than just the FANGs. I mean, we have the next generation, the Squares, the Rokus, and so forth, the Twilios. And so we have, again, well-known companies that has more of a tilt towards tech, but we have some healthcare in there as well, quite a bit of healthcare as well. The next-gen ETF, ERSX, is a little over 2.5 years old. And this is primarily non-U.S. or international small-cap companies. And so it provides an exposure that many people don't have. It includes many companies that are not ADRs. We invest directly into the markets, whether it's directly in Hong Kong or Thailand or Cambodia or wherever it may be, and as well as Europe and Latin America. So this provides a different exposure. And then we've got three mutual funds that are going to be converted to ETFs in the very near future.
Okay, so on the two ETFs, if I look at ENTR, it has approximately 30 holdings. ERSX, approximately 50 holdings. So, clearly these are more concentrated. You're really whittling down the respective investment universes here. How are you doing that? I mean, what's the filtering process?
Well, so we've got models that we've developed starting, over 20 years ago when I was working at Harvard studying at Harvard and writing the book with the former president of Chrysler Daimler. And we created this model that addresses what does it mean to be an entrepreneur. And so if you go to traditional databases, there's no filter identifier for entrepreneurial companies. So we have to kind of impute what does that mean. And so we go through a series of quantitative and qualitative data. We started with 15 traits. We've since moved it up to closer to 20. And we do this, and we do it on a very active basis. And so we're going through reams of data, going through more than 55,000 publicly traded companies, and identifying certain traits that we like to see within company holdings.
What are some of those traits?
Well, with the leadership criteria, it's a focus on the key members of the team. We like people who have been there for a fairly long period of time that have low turnover among senior management. We like to see the way they're investing their funds. So we see organizations that tend to grow or organically rather than through acquisition. When they grow through acquisition, they usually accrete SG&A savings or expansion to margins. And these are companies where they actually grow their clientele too. So they grow their employee base too. So these are companies that, again, because they're growing organically, for those investors who like ESG criteria, they have this too because the governance traits are very strong. That we actually select them based on this. They have low carbon footprint, so the E is very strong. And from a social standpoint, they're creating jobs in society. And so whereas the Fortune 500 lose jobs, these companies tend to create jobs in the marketplace.
I thought maybe a good way to sort of crystallize the overall idea here, can you highlight a company or two in either ETF that you think really captures the spirit of the entrepreneur factor?
Well, when you think about Square, this is a well-known company. You've got an iconic leader. I mean, people are very familiar with Amazon and Facebook and Netflix and Google, but there's a whole host of other companies, just below that mark that we've got, great entrepreneurs who are running them. And so Square would be an example. We've got globally, companies around the world. Tesla, of course, is a well-known example, but, people have studied, Elon Musk, quite a bit. But there are plenty of these companies that go on and on and on. Square, Roku, Cloudflare, Nvidia, the Datadog, DraftKings. I mean, the list goes on and on and on.
Joel, a few minutes left. I'm curious, what's your take on the current thematic ETF landscape, especially if we zero in on quote unquote disruptive innovation? So I'm sure you're familiar. You look at the success of ARK Invest. I know there are several other thematic ETFs that are built around disruptive tech. What's your overall take on this space?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, we were around before some of the others that you've mentioned. So we actually started this 15 to 20 years ago, and some of the others came out in the last 5-6 years. So the entrepreneurs, have, the, in many cases, they are the disruptors. They are the innovators. Many of these names that you find in other funds are in ours, too. We don't have them concentrated in tech funds or and healthcare funds and so forth, but we have many of the names, you know, mixed throughout all of our portfolios. Now, they had kind of a rough last 2 weeks, but, you know, this being March 9th, you know, as of the taping of the show, there's a very strong recovery. And so, you know, these, you know, tech stocks, these disruptors, you know, had an extraordinary 2020. They had an extraordinary beginning to 2021. They had, you know, 2 weeks where some of the profits were given back. But, you know, they're recovering very nicely as of, you know, today when we're speaking. And so, and we believe through the remainder of 2021, they're going to be very strong companies. I mean, these are companies that aren't going away. And in fact, what happens is periodically the pendulum swings, as most of your clients, most of your listeners know, it swings from one bucket to another. So it went from, you know, value to growth over the last few years, you know, and then from growth to value just recently, and now shifting back. I mean, we're seeing in the case of value stocks as of the time of this this recording, you know, some of these stocks are all-time highs, and they're flirting with bankruptcy. These are not entrepreneurial stocks. These are value stocks that were flirting with bankruptcy through much of 2020, and they're at all-time highs. And so that doesn't make sense either. So we're going to see a shift back to growth. You've got companies that have extraordinary – we have cases of fintech companies that have increased 700 or 800% in revenue growth over the last 2-3 years and 100x on profit growth over the last 2-3 years. And, you know, and these are companies globally that we're tracking. So I think long-term you're going to find investors like to gravitate – towards strong growth, disruptive stories. They may flirt with the idea of going away for a week or two, sometimes three, but they'll come back. And we think, you know, long-term value creation is with these types of companies. And we think listeners to your show will appreciate the long-term growth they have in their portfolios from these companies.
So just to summarize there, I think that's really interesting perspective. It sounds like you think this might be a bit of a head fake in value stocks, because I look at the market right now, there does seem to be a growing camp of investors who believe we might be seeing a more pronounced rotation out of growth stocks, right, into more value-oriented stocks. There are concerns over valuations, right, rising rates, but it sounds like you think growth may bounce back here more permanently.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm allowed to mention names, I can, you know, cite a few stories today.
Yeah, please.
So if you look at Avis, I mean, Avis is a company that, you know, for many of us growing up, you know, was running, in fact, their tagline was, we're number two, we try harder. Well, number one, Hertz, went bankrupt last year, and Avis has a capital structure very similar. They're at an all-time high. I mean, we look at Marriott International, I mean, they're at an all-time high, and, you know, their revenues were off 50, 60% last year. They've got rising debt levels, and they've got, you know, they've got rising debt levels with interest rates going up. And in competition with Airbnb and other companies, they're nipping at their heels. It's not unlike what's going on with Uber and Lyft and what they've done to the cab drivers. So, you know, the hotel industry is being disrupted, and yet this company is an all-time high. And then you've got restaurant chains like Bloomin, home, you know, the parent to Outback Steakhouse, among others. I mean, they've got, you know, rising debt levels, and their revenues were way off, and they've got, you know, obligations coming due. And they were flirting with bankruptcy, and they're at an all-time high. And then you've got SeaWorld. SeaWorld's perhaps the best example. You know, they were down 81% last year in revenues, and they haven't invested anything in property, plant, equipment. They're hemorrhaging cash, and yet their stock is an all-time high. It makes no sense. So you've got a lot of value stocks that are at or near all-time highs, or in the case of Avis, it's at a 15-year high. It makes no sense. I mean, they're in disrupted industries, and while it's important for listeners to know that, I believe that they should no way be near the bottom, you know, the depths of the pandemic, but they certainly should not be at all-time highs given the state of their future affairs. Whereas you have these growth stocks that until recently were off, you know, 20, 30% in the last few weeks as the taping of the show. Some were off 50, 60%. And they're, as of today, the taping of the show, you know, many of them are off, you know, 15 to 20% today. They're having a very strong recovery. And so we think long term, you know, the place to be is in growth. And if you're in some of these value names I just mentioned, you know, I'd strongly encourage you to get out, because whereas growth stocks might periodically drop 20, 30% or 50%, there's a floor. Whereas if you're in a value stock and it goes up to all-time highs and it goes bankrupt like Hertz or some of the retailers last year that we're familiar with, Sears and so forth, you can go to zero. And so value stocks that blow up go to zero. Growth stocks, which, you know, which give back some of their gains, might drop 20-30%. So we think long-term, the place to be is in these innovative, disruptive, entrepreneurial stocks that, you know, have you know, bright skies ahead.
Well, Joel, I think that's the perfect ending point. Really appreciate your perspective on the market. Certainly an interesting approach with ER shares, ETFs. Wish you continued success, and thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for being on your show. I'm happy to join anytime you like.
That was Joel Shulman, founder and chief investment officer of ER Shares. That'll do it for this week's ETF Prime. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Nate Geraci, or you can send comments through etfprime.com. Next week, I'll be joined by Rusty Vanneman, chief investment strategist at Orion Advisor Solutions. He's going to go in depth on a favorite topic of mine, direct indexing. And then Christian Magoon, founder of Amplify ETFs, one of my favorite guests, he'll cover several of their thematic ETFs. Until then, have a great week, everyone.